we're going to go back into open session now, so what do people need to know? Why I'm back now, Mark?
I've got a couple more meetings to do today, and then I'm going to go back.
Good.
And then I'm going to sleep.
And I will say
and get out of Boston for the marathon.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever been there for the marathon, but it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I don't know if you remember her name, but Joni Benoit, the marathoner.
Oh, yeah.
She's a good friend, and I've known her for years. And I used to run with her, and that's why I stopped running. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for the
phone. This is the closed session clicker.
What?
Oh, this is.
Oh.
So, we hired them years ago to work out legacy. To work out legacy real estate. Yeah.
Yeah, like a lot of these investments, like, were made in, like, I think the first investment was Red was like 2000, and then kind of built up 2005. That RCH was formed in 2011. So there was a long history before they came in.
So do we pay them a management fee plus carry?
Or just a management fee.
Just a management fee.
Yeah.
There's no upside to... Okay.
Yeah, it was just... It was hard to even know what they were walking into in 15, so structuring anything like that was just, you know... You see the IRRs, it would have been...
Because we did some... Who's doing the Cedars for us? They were here last
week. Clarion.
Clarion, so we had Clarion. We had AEW, he's one of the prime firms.
Yeah.
Yeah, we put up the real estate portfolio at 15 to four different... The people upstairs, CDK, their big portfolio too. Land to Hearthstone, hotel project to Barron's, or resort Napa stuff. This portfolio to AEW, and then to the Clarion stuff with the Tribute and the stuff in Cedars to them. So kind of $800 million that we split up across four different managers.
Do we know any? Do you guys talk to anybody at Arizona Public Safety Retirement System? Do you know anybody there?
I used to be involved with their trying to. I was on the committee. I was appointed by a couple of professional groups to be on the committee to restructure that. So I know people. I know the.
Do you know Mark Steed by chance?
I've met Mark. But I know the executive director and the board chair. But
yeah, I only
talked to Mark since I was up there 8 years ago.
Yeah, I only mention it because they're one of our largest LPs at our firm, but they are very innovative in terms of how they think about things, and the stuff's right in their backyard, and I just wonder, you know, they would be a really good buyer if this stuff is redeveloped and, you know, appropriated correctly. So I don't know if it makes any sense to make an intro. I know they've done a bunch of direct investing recently in real estate, so just a thought.
Actually, before we did the whole, when we were doing the rezoning, I talked to the board chair there because they were actually looking for a new place for their PSPRS office building. But I don't know what they've done since then.
If it makes sense at some point,
yeah.
I'm happy to connect.
Yeah, I've been on a few calls with Mark, so we'll talk and see if it makes sense. At least let them know that they're out there.
Yeah, there's no cost, right?
Yeah, no, make an intro and see where it goes.
Okay, Kelly, you want to do the monthly contribution?
Yes, the contribution report is on the same track that it has been. In total, the city is down 200 police officers from their hiring plan estimate, fires over by 82, so it's a net 118 under the number. We did reach out to the city to ask for an updated hiring plan. They provided information to us, but they only went out two years, so we said, could you add 18 to this, and sent it back. So we're waiting on that. But
they made a lot of progress in the last month, though. It went from 240 down in aggregate
right,
to 118.
Right. Yeah, it kind of comes and goes. We, as I've talked about before, the floor in 2023 has gone down, so it really isn't a factor anymore. So we're really, the contributions we get are going to be based on actual comp pay. There were two pay periods in this month, which was this February reporting. If you add the contributions from the employer side, which is the $12,193,000, plus the city the employee contributions of $4.7 million. That's about $8.5 million per pay period. And what you'll see I don't know if you've ever linked them together in your mind, but when Ryan goes over the portfolio update, he has a little cash flow there, and there it says $8.9 million is what the city contributions are, and I've never actually explained why these numbers are different. I don't know if anybody's ever tied them together and said this doesn't match. But we also get, in addition to the actual contributions, we get $13 million a year, which is $500,000 a pay period, so that's the difference when you see those numbers, in case you've ever wondered. But other than that, everything's on track. Okay. The next item is the board approval of education and travel. Nobody has requested any of these conferences, but if you're interested, Carol has listed for you the upcoming NCPRS conferences and the TechSPRS conferences. So if you're interested, reach out to Carol or me, and we can add you to the list and have a board vote on that prior to the conference. Okay. And then what we typically do when a trustee goes to a conference that DCFP pays any part of, the trustees will then, you know, just give a little insight into if they thought the conference was worthwhile or not, just so other trustees might want to consider it or avoid it in the future. So both Tina and Ken went to TechSPRS, and did either of you want to say anything about?
You want to go first?
TechSPRS?
Oh, I'll go first. Okay. No, it was a great conference. We had, I think, close to 600 registered individuals there. Of course, I'm on the board and I'm also on the legislative committee. We talk. I don't want to take any thunder from Josh, but the legislative committee asked me about our bill, and I said yes. You know, even though TechSPRS doesn't individually endorse a bill, I told as many as I could that yes, please tell your people to endorse that, like it, and we're all for it. And then the other one, of course, was the Prop bill that was there, and the latest we got from Eddie. Of course, Eddie Solis is also our TechSPRS lobbyist. Eddie said that the latest one, we kind of think that it's workable on the proxy vote. It's not finalized yet, but it appears to be workable. Everyone kind of agrees with that. The other thing was the ESG. Eddie and I guess the legislators are worried about TechSPRS talking about too much ESG, and there really wasn't, even though BlackRock was there, and BlackRock is a sponsor of TechSPRS, they were concerned about them putting on anything, and one of the BlackRock reps was just on a panel, that's all it was, so evidently the legislators allowed that or whatever. Some other good I got to meet with Manulife. There's a new app that TechSPRS bought for the conferences that is just outstanding. You can message people, the attendees, and see who's all there. And it's a heck of a lot easier than going up to everyone's name tag and saying, "Say I'm looking for somebody from Manulife or whatever." So I just emailed, messaged the Manulife guys, and they met with me real quick.
That was really great.
So I got to meet with them. Let's see what else. Legal issues, of course. Bob Klausner was always on top of everything. He's still very good in the pension world on litigation and letting us know all the top cases out there, what we need to be concerned with. CIO roundtable was really good. Another thing that was there was another panel I went to on alternatives, and one thing was called life settlement, which basically was just you're buying life insurance policies. And I didn't hear about that. I mean, that was popular back in the day when the AIDS epidemic first came out, and I didn't know alternatives were still doing that, so I was educated pretty good on that. And, I mean, when I first was hearing about it, I'm thinking, well, where do you find out about these? I kind of felt like it was an investment that was advertised in the back of a Penny Saver magazine or something, because I just wasn't sure on it. And then the last day, you know, Ari Rastegar was there, the big developer from Austin. So he kind of gives the same report as always. But you got a free book out of it if you stayed there for the last day. So
there you go.
It was called The Gift of Failure.
Yeah. Had many guests.
I was say, I think I got it in here. I haven't started. Have you started it yet, Dana?
Yeah.
This is it. You have to say it.
Yeah, I got to read it.
Have you finished it?
No. It depends on like, you know, how important it is to me. Like everybody else. My commentary you've gone over was a little bit more like overall. Couple things. One, by the way, that developer I thought was very interesting because it's just echoing what Ron was talking about, his mixed-use development, and he himself has been promoting these basically mixed, what he called pocket communities. So he's kind of coming in and he's kind of just popping up these communities, and it's like a different approach to urban development, which I found very interesting. It was just basically what he had done before and figuring out these mixed-use spaces and creating these small communities. Which is, he's doing Kyle.
Yeah.
Right, Kyle.
Just opened it up.
Yeah, just opened it up.
March.
And, yeah, exactly. And he says that, to his point, there is a need for residential. It's surprising, but it is, and that's what he was echoing. So that was the first thing. The other thing I thought was really interesting was an overall idea that, this is the first time I've ever heard it, that a lot of people were saying, is that nobody was talking about a 60-40 anymore, it was 70-30. Like, generally speaking, like, you didn't hear people saying, like, oh, the six, you know, the traditional 60-40. You were hearing everybody, more than one person, talking about a 70-30. I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, that sort of developed in the last 18 months when interest rates are so low.
Exactly.
People were saying, I'm not going to invest in fixed income at 1% or 2%. Right. We may be going back the other way now that interest rates are at 5%.
I know, which is ironic, but I did hear everybody mention that paradigm of 70-30, which I thought I had never heard before. But
I'm on like three other investment boards, and we've all switched to 70-30 in the last 18 months or so. Wrong time, but...
And then overall, a lot of discussion, really on the alternative. Just really on the alternative. Everybody talking about the alternative. And I think BlackRock did a fantastic job on non-banking direct lending and the need for that. So that really, really stood out. And I think the other thing that I want to say is that a lot of people did not really want to put themselves out there and say the failure in the banking was idiosyncratic or systematic or if we were going to see more. And what we saw was, you know, the seizing up of lending by regional banks for sure. And a lot of people had a lot of different ideas about that. And so there was no cohesive, no one was, everyone was saying, oh, this is just a minute. Nothing's going to happen. And other people were like, no, this is really kind of a harbinger of things to come. So there was, to me, just no continuity about visibility going forward.
Oh, it's way too early. I mean,
yes.
We're 5 weeks into that. I mean, it's way too early.
And so people were careful about how they thought where the Fed was going to go or what this was going to happen. So it was just a mixed bag of just projection. So that I found interesting. That it was just, no one knew. Really, I don't know. That was basically what I got away from that. But I think that was useful.
Yeah, a lot of interest on credit. You know, credit.
Yeah.
Given the fact that banks are getting out of that business or can't compete in that business. So middle market, loaning, doing deals overseas with investors that have strong dollars, you know, a good time to be doing things in Europe and Asia and the like. Just a quick quip on the on financing for survivors and so forth. At ERS, we were called into the governor's office and encouraged not to be involved in that area because of the political backlash that could emanate from doing those kind of investments. I think TRS went ahead and did some of that, but ERS could not. So an area that could be challenged.
Yeah, Makita's looked at that in the past too. And at first, their sales pitch is it's uncorrelated, right, to stock market and equity market.
Right.
Yeah.
But,
100%.
But aside from financial markets, the biggest risk for a pension plan is people living too long.
Yeah.
The biggest risk of that strategy is
people living
too long.
That was actually very interesting.
Yeah.
The actuarial one that was talking. She actually was talking about things like that. She's like, that is our biggest problem, that people people living too long. And the funny thing she said, which I thought was really good, she said, when you're looking at actuarial, but she really said this up front, and I was like kind of giggly, but there weren't a lot of people there anyway. She was saying that when you want to vet an actuarial company, make them do a lot of work. she's like, let them have their projections. You know what I mean? Like, it's good to compare them, and she's like, it's a lot of work, but they have it. You know, and the experience of studying and things like that. I thought it was funny. She goes, don't tell them I said that, but I guess what their projections are with life expectancy.
Yeah, but Mary Catherine's been on text for so long, she can say what she wants.
Okay, anything else, guys? Okay, why don't we move on, Ryan?
Okay. I know we're a little bit behind, so I'll try to move quickly here. So liquidation of the private market assets, I'll talk more about that. We have a quarterly update coming later in the agenda, but we got $34 million back here today. Most of that came from the Campbell Square project that Ron talked about and the J.P. Morgan Maritime Fund. We're 13 months now into the drawdown on the safety reserve. Kind of current initiatives, the consultant search, we issued the RFP on February 15th. We've gotten 9 responses back mid-March. Staff is going through the process right now, evaluating responses, and I expect for the members on the subcommittee, we should have a update out to you guys in the next couple of days on kind of initial cuts and where we want to go from there. So be looking on the lookout for that. On the global Invesco termination and the growth equity search, so we transferred the securities that were in the Invesco account. We terminated them at the March board meeting. And then we transferred to the transition account managed by Russell on 315. That resulted in a gain of 54 basis points just based on trading activity that day. We were buying into down markets and selling out of up markets that day. So going forward, until we find a replacement, Russell will manage that account kind of as a proxy index to the ACME growth. And I'll show you where on the performance report you'll see that. On rebalancing in mid-March, we had $30 million to redeploy. We took 15 of that and put it into the passive ACME IMI product. And we held $15 million back in cash within the safety reserve. So this is, I think, the third time when we've had proceeds to rebalance. We've kind of taken the half-and-half approach of putting half back into equity and replenishing the safety reserve with half of that amount, too. So we have $60 million right now to consider rebalancing. I expect we'll do the same type of 50-50 action on that. We'll communicate that to the IAC probably sometime next week on plans there, but that's the current thinking on it. So estimated year-to-date return for the overall portfolio is up 4%, up 5.8% for the public markets at cash, which is two-thirds of the portfolio. Dusted off this and kind of quarterly plan initiatives chart. I guess the first thing I wanted to say here, you could talk to a few people on the IAC and the board, but Mike Yan, who is our senior investment officer, he left DPFP a few weeks back. Got a really good opportunity in the fixed income space, so good for him. But we definitely need to add someone to the team. So we got a posting up within a day. We've gotten I'm very pleased with the interest we've gotten so far. We're looking to kind of move on that relatively quickly. I've had, 15 phone interviews and a few more set up in the next couple of days. So that's a big part of my focus right now.
What work experience generally are you looking for?
I would like to find someone that can hit the ground running, like knows what they're getting into with what working for a pension fund is like. We're looking for really at least 5 years of allocating or consultant type experience background. So, a lot of the resumes that come
generalist.
In. Yeah, I mean, like, so we have the public side of the portfolio that we could, I'm open and I've talked to people that have both private markets experience, given kind of what's going to be coming up there in the next 2 years, and also public experience. So I think we'll kind of shift the team and our focus based on what the hire looks like, but I'm open to
credit.
It's going to be generalist regardless, but, we have 60% in equity, so equity experience would be good versus, someone that's got some private equity experience could help out on that side of the portfolio when we start reinvesting. So
yeah, trying to get somebody who has both is the ideal.
Yeah, so, I think we got some really good candidates to look at, so I don't know how quickly it'll move, but we're doing our best to get someone in here. That's a good fit. IAC kind of asked for a work plan at the March meeting, so this, I laid out kind of what we plan to be working on for the next few quarters, and a lot of these will bridge between quarters. But we have a consultant RFP and reviews there. I expect to kind of have this communication out to the subcommittee, and then be interviewing some of my finalist firms and doing further diligence on them, and then bring a few choices back for the committee to interview. At the March IAC, we talked about the replacement search for Invesco and what that looks like. They approved a search process document that kind of lines out the criteria of what we're looking for. We also talked about updating the public equity structure, which is, you know, we have a 55% allocation to public equity, and this outlines kind of how we allocate that. So I'll point that out, kind of what the considerations are on a slide coming up here. On the screen for the global growth equity search, we've gotten it down to about 15 firms that passed all the screens. We're having calls with all those firms right now. The idea would be once we get to the June IAC meeting, we'll review the updated public equity structure, which might change some of the target weights within the portfolio, and then issue an RFP to 7 to 10 firms based on kind of Makita's names and our screen there.
What's the date of the June meeting?
June 20.
So it becomes of the board in July then?
No, probably like, so June 22nd for the IAC meeting, and then we'll talk about if we, the RFP process probably takes 60 days.
No, but you said about restructuring the allocation.
Oh, the public equity structure, ideally the IAC would look at it in June, and then the board would look at it in July for
approval. Right, okay, that's what I was referring to.
Okay. And then, so issuance of the global equity RFPs and kind of work through that in Q3. And then once we get through the consultant decision and see what that looks like, a bit more on the private market planning with initial pacing studies and update some of the IPS provisions related to private markets kind of later in the year. Okay, so on the banking situation, we sent this update out to the board mid-March, but after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, we reached out to all our investment managers just to better understand the regional bank exposure in the portfolio. We had two private managers that had Riverstone, which is a private debt firm, had bank accounts with SVB. They immediately, you know, shifted activity over to B of A with backup accounts. They had less than $1 million in deposits there, which are full now. Industry Ventures, which is a venture capital fund of funds, they used First Republic Bank, which kind of had their shakiness. And, later in the month, they set up redundant accounts at BFA. There's a lot of portfolio company exposure just in venture capital and, you know, likely account changes there, and just what that does to the venture capital space and lending and capital availability is, I think, going to be an issue. So as far as our public equity or public portfolio, at large, we had $5.6 million to U.S. regional bank exposure, which is less than 40 bips of the public markets allocation. So not a ton. Most of it was in the U.S. small cap portfolio with Eastern Shore, a little bit in Boston Partners, IRM, and Longfellow. So on to our banking relationships. Let's see, J.P. Morgan's our custodian bank. We use Texas Capital Bank for payroll and operating accounts. So once a month, the $28-29 million that we send out to pay benefit payments flows through TCB and then out to the beneficiaries.
So by payroll, we mean the pension payroll, not that payroll.
Yeah, we don't pay $28 million
a month. It's not that much.
They do.
So that's the exposure, though, of somebody
yeah.
like
yeah.
I mean, the day you got the money, you're getting ready to pay the payroll, and something happened with that bank, which mm-hmm. is what happened with Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
You could be at risk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does it make sense to be using a bigger bank?
So, like, I would say we've talked, you guys have looked at financials. We are somewhat comfortable with their financial stability. It's more we're having service issues with them right now. Why we, you know, probably multiple reasons to look at making a change, but the service issues have been kind of prompting that too. So, that being said, we talked to J.P. Morgan about setting up redundant backup accounts or moving that over to them. J.P. Morgan seems completely uninterested in taking on our business, which is, you know, we've had multiple hard conversations. Yeah, they
really.
So Silicon Valley is so specialized to private equity and venture lending. My company's operating accounts were at Silicon Valley and are still there.
Okay.
And there are countless people that have left, like, upon this news, left Silicon Valley, went to J.P. Morgan, Wells, B of A, and the service was so bad mm-hmm. that they literally have gone back to the receivership bank
really?
At Silicon Valley because of now what's an implicit guarantee from the government.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of business that has left and gone back. Believe it or not, do
that implicit guarantees only have a certain amount of time. One to 2 years.
Well,
that's the thing.
In the history of failures and bank failures in the country, there's never been a loss on the insurance one.
So I think on our side, you know, our real exposure is when we transfer the wire from J.P. Morgan to TCB 3 days before, two days before.
Right, 2 days.
So it's 2 days most months, but it could go over the weekend. You know, so you've got a lot of money sitting there, but only, you know, for a short period of time. My issue that is really a recent issue with TCB is not failure. It is they had an ownership and a management change. And prior to the last, I guess, 6 months, I was 100% confident if we ever had a problem, I could call someone over there and they would fix it. And the problem I'm concerned about is for some reason our ACH doesn't run and the 5,000, you know, direct ACHs don't go out to the members at the last of the month. I knew if we ever had a problem, I would have somebody there to fix it. I no longer feel like I have that.
You are not alone in the view of recent management changes at that company. I mean, there's an industry view that it is a pretty poorly managed bank.
So we're looking at it from kind of all aspects. What makes sense for just security as, you know, you have a problem, somebody can fix it, the bank stability, how it flows with our custody account and what's the right time and, you know, how we deal with all those things together. It's because, you know, changing custody bank is a huge project.
Well, you wouldn't change the custody. I mean, it would just be a payroll account.
If we wanted to, ideally, we would have everything at the same bank, you know, so you wouldn't have to move the money 2 days before and, you know. So those are the things. It's complicated. We are looking at the issues. We don't have a conclusion yet.
Seeing this from other pensions, it is common to do it the way you have it structured.
Yeah.
I mean, ideally, great if one bank wants to do it all, but I see this a lot where some smaller regional bank is who you're using for pension checks, and a national big name like J.P. Morgan is who you're using for custody.
Okay, so you'll get back to the board with whatever research and conclusions you're reaching.
Okay. A lot of these charts are standard monthly charts, so a few comments on them. Just looking at the equity market drawdown from the beginning of 22 till now, it hasn't changed much in the last week. I guess what I would say here, so we're down 15% on the ACME IMI. It's an ongoing discussion internally and with Makita on, like, what does exiting the drawdown on the safe reserve look like? What market levels do we need to be back to? What occurs when that occurs, which I think the money, instead of going back into the equity portfolio, goes to refill the safe reserve, which we're kind of doing half of now, but we're monitoring it and kind of trying to determine what that exit looks like at some point here. Fed funds rate, that green line is market expectations versus the Fed plot. It's moved a lot in the last month. The two-year treasury was above 5, kind of before all this SVB stuff mid-March, and we're currently below 4. So a lot of movement in the shorter-term treasury rates. So this is a chart from J.P. Morgan, Guide to the Markets, which at least we can still use J.P. Morgan for their charts. But it's looking at cycles of U.S. versus EFA, international stock market outperformance, and usually these are very long cycles of U.S. outperformance versus international outperformance. This last one has been a very, very long one at 14 years. The way they're categorizing it, we've just shifted back into, you know, a potential cycle of international outperformance. So I guess all that's to say, this is why we are taking a global approach to our equity allocation and allowing the managers to kind of decide where and how they want to allocate across all global markets.
looking at the change in market value bridge chart, we ended the month with, in the quarter, with $1.876 billion in AUM, investment gain of $72 million, $25 million going out to pay benefit net outflows, so preliminary return of 4%. Looking at the public market snapshot, okay, so kind of middle of the page here is where you'll see the, see if I can do it, the Russell, the new ACWI growth, which is a month of performance. Invesco will drop off after this month, and then, you know, we'll replace them at some point once we find a new manager. So looking at the middle column on year-to-date, just if you think that, point out kind of the growth value dynamic has flipped and growth has outperformed. Year to date, Walter Scott, our quality growth manager, is up 10% compared to the benchmark 7.3. And then we've seen good performance in Global Alpha and our international small cap, which is outperforming by 400 basis points. And then RBC has continued its EM equity, good performance, outperforming by a little over 200 basis points year to date. Any other questions on public manager performance? Okay, so on this is the asset allocation detail, and what we're really looking at when we talk about the updated public equity structure is we have 8% targets each to our four global managers, and we think that might be, a, you know, just from a concentration standpoint, a little heavy to have 8% to one manager, just talking about some other plans on how they're allocating and some of Makita's clients. So Aaron will get into it in a little bit, but part of their recommendation is increased passive exposure, so we're looking at like if, what level we could bring those 8% targets down to and potentially add that to passive. So we're looking at a few different options there. I think maybe something like 6% each to the global managers and then add that to passive might be a reasonable approach.
Is that four managers at six?
Yeah, four managers at six. What we're looking at is like making sure we don't end up with too much of a small cap overweight by bringing those down, which we're kind of just trading large cap for passive, so I don't think so. But just make sure we're kind of in line with market weights the way we want to be and just see how that look-through exposure looks by tweaking those allocations.
What's the logic of the move from more active to more passive?
Aaron, what's Jill's rationale? I can talk about ours, but, you know.
Philosophically, we think it makes sense to have that core, low-cost, slug or portion, and I think what Brian was alluding to was in our reports coming up next, we kind of compare it to what we see out in the universe, and DPFP is a bit of an outlier in terms of being almost, you know, 85% active. Not our reason for recommending it, just that's an observation that you need to consider when you're positioning your portfolio, if you're comfortable being different.
Some more position relative to others.
Yeah, and I think the other part of it is our 8% is probably a little bit higher relative to other plans. So I think by adding a little bit of passive exposure and bringing those down, we can stick to kind of having four high conviction managers in the global portfolio without being an outlier in either area.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, if you're going to stick with this concentrated approach of managers, to keep, and you don't want them to be too high of a portion, then it doesn't make sense to keep adding more managers, and then you're going to have a passive-like portfolio at active fees. So you bring them down, you got to put it into the index.
And I mean, I would say that, you know, the active part of the portfolio has done its job. It has outperformed net of fees over most time periods. So, you know.
Well, and peak valuations with higher volatility would favor active management, which is what I'm asking.
Yeah.
If you're moving back towards something that's more in line with others, then that makes sense.
Okay. So, yeah, that would go to that recommendation to the IAC in June and then back to the board in July would be the current plan. Safe reserve, $125 million in that portfolio compared to a target of $170. Current kind of trends on net outflows is $9.5 million per month. So we have enough to cover 13 more months of benefit outflows with kind of the expected holdback from the NIC amount of proceeds that came in that extended out another 3 months. So, you know, we're still using it for drawdown, but we're getting closer to back to full target in that portfolio. From a cash standpoint, we had $70 million at the end of the quarter. That's plenty to get us through Q2. And then, like I said, we're probably going to be holding a little bit more back in that portfolio. So looking, we have a pretty good runway on cash as well.
The cash is what percent right now, sir?
What?
Percentage of the savings, sir?
Cash is, I guess, like two-thirds-ish, 50, you know, over 50% of the safety reserve. It's the $70 million in that chart compared to the 55 in IRM. So at some point.
And are we still staying at a 12, 13 month, or are we going to like a year and a half, like more like 18 months?
So the allocation is 18 months. So right now we have 13 out of the 18 months. If we were at full allocation, we would have 18 months. I guess what, another way to think about it is, we put this into drawdown in March of 2022. So if we hadn't replenished the safety reserve at all, we'd be running out in September of this year. But by holding some money back and still redeploying some money, the kind of this 50-50 approach, we've extended it from September of 23 to May of 24. So, you know, we're, you know, 13 months into the original 18 months that we had in that portfolio. So, and then as we come out of this drawdown, whenever that occurs, we would fill this back up to the 18 months, so more back into IRM, and then hopefully not have to use that portfolio to pay benefits until, you know, there's another drawdown. So, concept at least. Okay, so just the review plan looking forward. We expect to have Hancock come in to talk about the ag portfolio in May, and then we'll work our way through kind of the rest of the private markets and public equity and fixed income portfolios later in the year. Okay. So next item is report on the Investment Advisory Committee meeting. I've covered most of it. I guess, Bill, anything you wanted to add from that?
No, I think you've covered the key. I mean, it's the growth search, and it's looking at the allocation between past and active are the two major things, and any shifting there. The key is going to come back and let us know any other recommendations they have.
Yeah, and I would say it was the two new members, Luke and Jamil. It was their first meeting in March as well. All right, so Kelly, do you want to give a quick intro to the next item here?
Sure. This next item, which Aaron will present, is a report that is required by the legislature. You might remember in 2019, the legislature passed SB 322. And with that, in 2020, we hired Makita to do an evaluation of our investment practices and performances to meet the criteria. And at that time, we had to do they had to look at the whole portfolio with the first report. That was the requirement. In 2021, the legislature kind of tweaked the law that they passed previously and added the fact that now we have to, the plan has to comment on the recommendations that the reviewer makes. So you'll see now there's a recommendation in this plan. When SB 322 was originally passed, it was laid out so the first time you had to do the full report, and then in future subsequent reports you could pick an asset class, one asset class, and do it. We went ahead and had Makita do the whole portfolio because we didn't want people to question, well, why did they just do that asset class and why are they avoiding this asset class? And we thought, might as well do the whole thing as we head into 2024 and 2025. So that's what this report is. Where it goes from here is, if the board adopts the report, then it will be sent to the PRB. The PRB takes reports from all the different pension systems, combines those, does a summary of sorts, and then they submit that to the governor and the legislature. So that's what happens to this after it leaves here. With that, I will turn it over to Aaron.
All right. I think I have 1 minute, according to the order of business. So I'll be high level, but not, I don't know if I can keep it down
we
in time.
We actually have
5 minutes there. We actually got 5 minutes.
We have more time built in for some of these items.
Okay. Well, this is one of those, as a good intro, this is a report that is a requirement. So this is we've built the structure to match the law. So to be frank, it's a report that's best read and not presented. So I'm going to go almost from the intro pages to the end to keep it high level. Some disclosure requirements up front. This matches what the law requires. Same here on qualifications. So we did this back in 2020. This was new to pensions and new to consultants. So we all learned from the ground up. All our Texas pension clients engaged with us in 2020 to do it, and you are the first to kick it off now in 2023, but this just shows we are qualified to do it. So here's the law, here's the scope, and this is how the report is structured. There are five evaluation areas. The first looks at investment policy statement, that's Section A. Section B is all about asset allocation and asset liability management. Section C is about fees. Section D is governance and how the board operates together, how decisions are made. And Section E is all about manager selection and monitoring. So I'll show you in here how it's structured. Let's go to the end of Section B. The whole report, the Texas Pension Review Board provides guidance on all the areas they cover in each section. That is the outline we've used for your report. We go through each topic. On the left, this is page 72. And we basically evaluate your system and what you're doing relative to the topic or focus area they've outlined. You see here, this is all about, they want to see if the board is doing stress testing on your asset allocation and liability management. So we show some exhibits of what work you've done over the years, here on page 76, 76, 77. And importantly, really, each section has one of these, our analysis followed by our recommendations. And overall, and at the back, there's a summary of all the recommendations, which I'll get to right now. No groundbreaking recommendations. A lot of the recommendations are continue to do what you're doing. Continue to follow the path you've been on. So we didn't discover any major red flags. Go all the way to the back. Again, this is a report best read. Conclusions, we've got the five sections. We think in each section you're meeting industry best practices, and importantly, you're adhering to your established policies. So, stamp of approval. We summarize all the recommendations here at the end, which is page 107 and 108. But then, new this year, I'll bring you to, so staff has put all of our recommendations in another summary, and their response to that. And this is what needs to be discussed today and approved and then submitted to the Texas Pension Review Board. So I think the best approach would be, are there any recommendations or responses that you want to discuss and debate? You can see most of them are, staff agrees or agrees with some caveat language.
I would say,
give us a minute or two just to get through
this? Yeah, I would say the biggest one that is just kind of tweaks the portfolio is the passive exposure and what that looks like and how that impacts the active part of the portfolio and rationales for doing that.
You got the one on the investment policy statement. Who believes that? Staff believes that we should review that every year?
That was our recommended answer. Staff was the answer.
Yeah, I mean, in the IPS, they said we're going to do a full study every 3 years, and we're going to look at that to allocation annually. So,
okay.
Especially given the changes in kind of the fixed income environment, I think it's prudent to look at it this year.
Got a recommendation. Is this Makita's recommendation on the continuity of the board?
The left column are all our recommendations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that an appropriate comment for you guys to be making?
So the,
I mean, it's spelled out by the legislature what the terms are, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of this, in my understanding from the Pension Review Board, is you get an external consultant to provide opinions on how boards should operate, and your turnover is much higher than we seek. So.
Okay.
I do think it's helpful if we want to try to change that in the legislature to say we've had this review and the reviewer's recommendation is, you know, just what Aaron said, our turnover's higher. That might help us get it changed.
Yeah, to your point, Bill, you might have no power to do anything about our recommendation.
How are you going to accomplish that?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the turnover has really just been people who committed for 3 years and
right.
have done their terms and now need to move on back to their jobs.
Right, but we had Tina and Gilbert who had term limits, and Nick's a term limit issue. You're a term limit. You would want to stay forever.
Yeah, we heard you're getting off in a few months, so we got to throw this comment out.
Term limits are good for a lot of things. Yeah, just spacing it out somehow. Okay. So we do, any other thoughts or comments? We do need a motion to approve this to be submitted to the Pension Review Board. Anybody want a motion? Tony, thank you.
I'll second.
Second, Marcus, thank you. Anybody opposed? Do we need an affirmative some on the phone to get a 6 vote?
It would just be nice to have a voice.
Okay, why don't we...
I know there's a delay.
Yes, Nick said yes.
Okay. Anybody else? Yes? Go on record. Mark, Steve?
Armando's a yes.
Okay. Armando, thank you. Okay, we've got an approved, no opposition. So
I'm for it.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Did you want to go to the legislative item? Or
yes, why don't we do that? We've got, you want to introduce this, Kelly?
Well, yes, so I'll do a little intro and I'll turn it over to Josh.
Okay, great.
So as the board knows, every month during the legislative session, we provide the board with both an update of DPFP-specific bills that were either trying to pass because the board asked us to do so, or other bills that impact us. And then there's some other bills that aren't just DPFP-specific that do have an impact on pension one way or the other. So Josh will give you an update on where we are with various bills.
Thanks, Kelly. So there are two bills, as we all know, that are planned. The first bill is HB 4034. That deals with the line of duty death benefit being enhanced to 100%. That bill was passed out of committee and referred to the local and consent calendar. And so the bill, as was passed out, was only prospective and did not have the added language that the board wanted that provided for adding prior beneficiaries, increasing their benefit to 100% on a prospective basis. There is a committee substitute. Well, it's not technically a committee substitute because it hasn't been presented, but there's language that's been drafted by legislative counsel to provide for that. What we've been told by our legislative consultants is that the bill will come out of the House side the way it's written, and it will go over to the Senate side. This gets a little confusing because there's two Johnsons sponsoring the bill on the House and the Senate side. Representative Johnson is sponsoring the House bill. Senator Johnson is sponsoring the Senate bill. Our legislative consultant has advised us that Senator Johnson intends to propose the committee substitute language that will provide for the enhancing the benefit of the prior beneficiaries so that their benefits increase to 100% on a prospective basis. If that happens, then we would expect it to be passed out of the Senate that way, and then there would be it would be worked out in conference that hopefully the House side would get adjusted and the bill would be passed with the enhanced benefit. So, you know, obviously none of us can guarantee anything that will happen down at the legislature, but based on what we were hearing from Senator Johnson's office through our legislative consultants, we believe that the bill will ultimately come out of the Senate the way the board would like it, and hopefully will then come out of the legislature the way the board would like it.
Do we think by any chance, I mean, was the bill that came out of the House an oversight, or just was it intentional that they didn't want to include that, or do we know?
So we have the amendment, we have the committee substitute that came out before the hearing, and we expected that the committee substitute would have been introduced during the committee hearing. For some reason, it was not. We don't know for sure what that reason was, but and then we thought maybe it would get changed before it passed out of that committee to the local and consent calendar. That just didn't happen. I feel, as Josh said, there's no guarantees with the legislature, but I feel like it'll be okay on the Senate side. It's just a little messy.
Yeah, I think we're definitely, I mean, the board indicated its desire, and we've been pursuing that, and we're hopeful that that's ultimately will what Governor Abbott will sign. So,
that's... Do you need to have our legislative people lobby a little bit with the House side?
So they have been working it, and if you look at the bill right now, there are a lot of people that have signed on as sponsors and co-sponsors, which shows their support. So.
Yeah. I think certainly our legislative consultants are hard at work. I don't think there's any issue there. I think it's more just, well, nobody knows exactly what happened, but hopefully this will all get corrected and passed as we want it to happen.
So if the amendments are done and how and the Senate approves, then you have to go back to the House because it was voted one way, with, and then how does that work?
What happens is there's a most of the time what happens is you go to a conference committee for these bills that come out differently on the House side and the Senate side, and then depending on how it worked out, if the Senate bill is amended the way we've seen the language and we're fine with it, the way the board wants it, then it would go back to the House side. The House would pass the Senate bill, and then hopefully the governor signs it.
That was more like a logistical the way initially.
Right, it's an important amendment,
yes,
and I do think, you know, and so it is, in my mind, it is a logistical issue. It's a very important issue,
yeah.
Right, but it's
existing.
Right.
The timeline of what might be happening over the next week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks?
We're hopeful that it's going to get... So the bill on the Senate side goes to the now pension bills are heard by the Senate Finance Committee. Senator Huffman's the chairman of that committee. We're hopeful in the next week or two it's going to get a hearing there and passed out. It meets the Senate, the Finance Committee meets twice a week, so the Pensions Committee only meets once a week, so hopefully that happens sooner rather than later. I don't think there's a... I don't think there's any timing issue that we're running up against any deadlines anytime soon. I think it'll hopefully, you know, there doesn't appear to be any opposition to any of these, so I think it should happen. Like I said, it's made hopefully more logistics than anything at this point.
Once it happens, is that like a blueprint for other pension systems when they have this issue come up as far as...
So other pensions, they're all different already, so they don't really need a blueprint. Some people already have 100% benefit. Some people, I think San Antonio is actually down the legislature this year trying to increase their off-duty benefits to 75%. So it's not really.
Yeah,
Yeah, I talked to El Paso, so they are 100%.
So that's House Bill 4034. The other House bill that affects or that amends our plan is House Bill 4653. That's the bill that increases the years that people can be in drop and get credit in drop from 10 to 20 years. That bill has not yet been passed out of committee. It was heard a week ago. As of yet, it has not been reported out. It has not been passed. Now, I saw and noticed that there was a hearing set today. I think Representative Caprillion's desk. He's the chairman of the committee. That's not unusual down in Austin for that to happen. They may pass out some bills that are pending, and that's one of them. There is one aspect of that. There's a technical legal aspect of that bill that I will discuss in closed session that I think merits the board's attention, and so we'll talk about that when we get to closed session legal. But for now, that bill is still, as of this moment, I believe still pending in the session. The only other bill that I would note, and Ken mentioned it earlier, was the ESG bill, Senate Bill 1446. It was passed out of committee. The anticipation is that it will get changed in the House. I think, you know, there's a lot of aspects to it. Tom can probably talk about some of those from the state perspective. You know, the state systems are the big players here. TRS, TMRS, TCDRS are all at $30-40 billion. TRS is the big one. I don't know, they're 200 something billion now. They all are weighing in various ways, or they're not weighing in. I think it's got a lot, has gotten better, but I think there's still aspects of it that could impact on all pension systems, including ours, and it also depends on how you read it. I mean, we're just standing by, seeing where it goes. So I think there's still work that will occur on it, and obviously once the final version comes to the board, we'll, you know, advise and tell you where we think initially the impact on our system would be. But I think it's fair to say that there's concern that from all pension system investment staffs, both the investment, the CIOs, and the legal staffs, about sort of how that bill will come out and how it will impact all the systems. So TCDRS followed their fiscal note. It was pretty big. I don't know if other systems have followed a fiscal note, but their view of what the impact is. But it's not insubstantial at this point. So that bill will clearly get changed and will get worked out in some form or fashion if it does in fact pass. That's really the only bill that right now that would directly materially impact our pension system.
Questions? Any more questions? No? If not, why don't we move on to the next item on our agenda? Ryan, you're going to cash flow projections?
Yeah. Okay, so this is our quarterly review of the activity in the private asset portfolio and then projections going forward. As a reminder, there's a detailed schedule in the closed session materials that outlines by asset expected capital calls and distributions over the next 2 years. So we build this up asset by asset. Ended the quarter with $560 million in private market assets, just under 30% of the portfolio. That's down from $591 million last quarter. This date of 9/30/16 is kind of predating the secondary sales that we initially took on when we were having first kind of liquidations in the portfolio. So we've liquidated $1.3 billion plus out of the portfolio since then, and then over $880 million since the new board took over in September 17. Quarterly activity. We had two small capital calls in the Asian infrastructure fund. And then, as I said in the portfolio update, vast bulk of activity coming out of the private asset portfolio was from the Campbell Square office sale, and then the J.P. Morgan Maritime Fund, which is in wind down. We have had two distributions in Q1, $16 million come back to us. There's about $20 million remaining in that fund, so I expect that to be a big driver of distributions in the next few quarters as well. This chart is showing the blue bars are quarterly distributions, the orange are quarterly cash outflows. If you just look at the last kind of 2 years, it's ebbed and flowed anywhere between $9 million a quarter and $72 million a quarter in net inflows from the private asset portfolio. We talked last couple times that we expect to be very lumpy going forward, and 80% of what we plan to sell, or what's left to sell from the portfolio, is going to come from Huff, Lone Star, and AEW. So there's just a more concentrated exposures within what's remaining in the portfolio now. This is a new chart. We talked about it a little bit last month, but we went back and looked at kind of quarterly net inflows from the private asset portfolio and how much, which is the blue bar, compared to our net benefit outflows and what type of coverage we got from the private asset portfolio. So you can see in every year except for 2020 COVID year, we've had over 100% of our benefit needs get covered by inflows from the private markets portfolio. In total, you know, 113% of net benefit outflows have been covered by the private asset portfolio in the last 5+ years. So at some point that'll flip where we're not going to have anything else to sell and money can be going out, and that'll be, you know, another kind of exercise, where's money coming from to fill the hole, but that'll be a good problem to have. Looking at the forward projections, blue bar is kind of where we've been gotten to through Q1. The blue dotted line is projections going forward for the next year and a half. We end this at the end of 24. The only big changes quarter to quarter that we've made is just based on some update from the GP, we've moved the Huff Energy sale from 2023 into 2024. So just same story with them, not a lot of visibility. You know, we'll see what the value is when it sells. And
you know, do we have any new information from them, or we just lose less confidence that they were doing it?
We've got some updates that, you know, the sales seem a little bit further off than maybe we thought a few months ago. So they're very active, but I think, you know, finding the right buyer for that type of asset is a challenge. And then we moved the Maritime Fund. We split that between 2023 and 2024. We moved that back into 2023. So $20 million remaining there, expected to be coming back. We were a little bit more conservative on the cash inflows from the AEW portfolio than what Ron had laid out. So, you know, we're 74 remaining versus 58 at the end of 24. So a little room for potential upside there. I mean, this is looking at what is left now, how much of it is considered legacy, which is the yellow highlighted assets in the detailed schedule. And then the gray bar is kind of our normal non-legacy private assets. I just point out, of the gray amount, a big chunk of this is the ag portfolio, Hancock Manulife, that we plan to keep longer term. So $100 million is kind of spoken for in the longer term allocation. It's stuff that we plan to keep. And this is looking at our private market allocation, a little bit of a spike about a year ago from write-ups in the private equity portfolio, and then denominator effect as public markets started going down. Just below 30% compared to our long-term target of 15. This kind of goes into some of the thinking on the consultant search and when are we actually going to be restarting the private markets investment program? What does that look like? How do we design that when, in terms of what we're contracting for with the consultant and when to start those services up? So, any questions on the private asset report? Hopefully at some point here this will turn from a inflows report to a pacing study and what we plan to do. So,
hopefully. Okay, great. Okay, Kelly, this is a unique item.
unique item. On page 123, we are bringing back the staff 457 plan again. We talked about this last month where, thank you, we asked the board permission to change our investment makeup that is currently available to staff to more low-cost funds, and that was fine. In the process of doing that, staff discovered that when the 457 was put in place in 2005, it does not appear that the board approved that. So we're bringing this to you for...
This is the way it works now, this is just employee contribution.
Right, there's no system contributions. Right, it's just employee.
So we basically are responsible for the investment options, so I'm selecting the investment options.
Right, the board's the fiduciary for the plan.
Okay. Yeah, and I think, you know, we are a little slow process because it's a small way of trying to drag them along to get the plan changed to get more options, more index, things like that, which a wider variety and much lower cost things. We're going to get that done here hopefully in the next few weeks or months. And this is purely cleanup from 18 years ago, I guess, of just, you know, that it's just, this is an oversight for whatever reason back then that the board never approved the plan because the plan went forward and it's been in existence since 2005, and there's been contributions and so on by employees, and it's functioned fine. It's just there was never an approval, so we felt like it was appropriate to get it cleaned up.
What is the size of the plan?
6-ish million, I think.
Okay. Tina, I'm sorry.
The board is the fiduciary for both the staff, well, when we had the 401A, the defined contribution before TMRS, and for this plan, which is why at the last meeting I asked, are you okay if we change options?
Just out of curiosity, what is our liability
there?
Liability is if we get sued because we're using investment options with higher cost or making bad selections or what conflict, there is a potential fiduciary liability.
Yeah. So we're giving that discretion to the employee.
Well, we're giving them a slate of funds they can choose from. Right now, the slate of funds are not the lowest cost funds. We're trying to rectify that too. You know.
That's where the bulk of the losses have been, is by not having the lowest cost options for an appropriate investment. That's where a lot of settlements and ERISA cases anyway have been occurring.
Right.
Irrespective of performance.
Yeah, that's a lot of irrespective of performance. I mean, again, in a mutual fund structure, there's like six classes of shares.
Right.
And if you qualify for the lowest cost, but you have your employees in a higher cost one, they're good. Well, performance will follow. By having a higher expense ratio with the same investments, you have a lower performance.
Makes sense.
There's some groups tend to have a committee set up to oversee this. You know, just to make sure you've got the right options and not too many options, and you're meeting the needs of the constituents.
But it's typical of board. I mean, even when I was at American Airlines, we had committees, we had a pension department, we had an asset administration committee of officers, but the board was ultimately the responsibility. The company would be the one getting sued on that.
And we did talk about it a couple of years ago with the board, and they did appoint the four executives as the committee, but they can't delegate their fiduciary.
What legal implications are there of us ratifying something going back that long? I mean, do we need to ratify it, or do we just, since you hadn't done, we can approve it going prospectively, do we need to ratify it going backwards?
Well, you know, to be honest, you've probably, in effect, taken an, you know, implicitly ratified it, you know, if you didn't come out and say, you know, you're disclaiming it. So I think this is just pure cleanup so that when we go forward and sign things and do things, we can say there's some board authorization and things like that. So realistically, unless you want to come out, like I say, and have a motion to disclaim all prior activity, you know, it's probably not really any legal effect. So I think this just makes it cleaner to be able to point to something from our perspective to administer the plan. That's really all it is.
My gut would be not, I mean, just not do anything. We've authorized it going forward and let if that's not creating other issues.
Well, I could say it may create an issue. It may have to come back to you if it creates an issue in signing something because I feel like it's not. There hasn't been an appropriate, I mean, I guess, are you suggesting not having any motion, or are you suggesting?
No, I think
executed the amendment. You know, we authorized the executive.
Oh, okay, authorized.
To execute the amended restatement.
Okay.
For a compensation plan.
I think we're just being agreement going forward, and I think backward, if there was no ever discussion, you could just say, just because we made discussions and agreements before, that it was the way we were acting as fiduciary.
Okay.
So if we just put a period after plan, compensate for a compensation plan.
That's fine. I'll talk about it a little more in closed session. But
okay.
But if that's the motion you want to pass, no, that's fine.
Okay. I would suggest we do that, and so we cut it off without any prior ratification. Do we have a second for that?
A second.
Marcus. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed?
Aye. Nick.
Anyone?
Did you guys get Mark? No, I said aye. I don't know if you guys have been hearing me.
Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, I think. Okay, I think we've got everybody. Anybody opposed? No. Okay. Kelly, do you want to give your executive director's report before we go in back into closed session?
Sure. The NCPRS monitors are there for your review. As far as open records requests go, we've received two since the last board meeting. Both of them were from research type people, no member. One was disclosed and one is in the process, but no problems with those.
Okay. Any questions for Kelly? None. Why don't we go to the closed session for the legal?